Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing an interview I did with Jay Patterson, who is part of the ensemble company currently appearing in Glengarry Glen Ross at the Oslo Repertory Theatre Company. Jay's story is compelling. It starts out with the story of how he overcame a huge roadblock, and then he's catapulted to Broadway. It's a fascinating story, so hang on. Here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from
Show. The Lynn Show is about living the life you were meant to live, about being the person you really are. Unfortunately, it is my opinion, based on my many, many years as a psychotherapist, that most of us are not living the life we were meant to live, and we are not the person we really are. We're a version of that person. The us that we demonstrate, that we expose to the world, is true. It's a version of who we are. It's just not the whole truth of who we are. Because for many, many different reasons, many, many, many of us were forced to hide, to pretend, to deny, to dissemble some of the aspects of ourselves. And we get so good at the dissembling, at the pretending, that we actually come to believe that our pretense is the truth. We are the limited version of ourselves that we are portraying and believing in. I see this over and over again in the work that I do. People come to see me to be able to do something that they didn't think they could do, or to stop doing something that they don't want to do anymore. And they are hopeful quite often that I will help them develop something that they don't already have. And over and again, we find that they already have it. It's just buried so deeply that they don't know it. So the work I do, which of course is psychotherapy, and which, by the way, is currently all on the telephone. So if you're curious about psychotherapy or interested in having therapy but you don't want to go to somebody's office, you might be interested in that. And maybe this is a good time to say that I wrote an article about that. It's called Psychotherapy on the Go, which is at my website, thelynnshow.com, thelynnshow. Don't leave the E out of Lynn, thelynnshow.com. And if you're going up on my website while you're there, you might like to listen to the first chapter of my book or to listen to the interviews that I've done. They're all up there on the website, including the one I'm going to play for you today. Today I'm playing an interview with Jay Patterson. Jay Patterson is and has always been an actor. As with all of the people that I interview, Jay has dedicated his life and or his living to an art, and in Jay's case, of course, that art is acting. Jay says that he never wanted to be anything other than an actor. And you can hear from the two stories that he tells about his childhood, the one in which he is Mr. Clean, the commercial man, and the other in his discovery of theater, when his parents take him as a very young child to his first theater experience. You can hear that what Jay is and has always been is an actor. That's what he says, and it's clearly true, as he has made a life of this work. But Jay had a serious roadblock to overcome. And it took him to his junior in high school, which is late for most people who know they want to be an actor, know it and are playing with it much earlier than that. Jay had to wait until his junior year, but then he was lucky enough to have a teacher, and it is my experience that teachers quite often are the saviors who saved him. I'm not going to tell you more about it because Jay tells it better than I do. But the point I do want to make here is that it's not too late to, I want to say, recover, not discover, but recover aspects of yourself which you have had to deny. In Jay's case, this aspect was something that he knew about. He knew he wanted to be an actor. He was just afraid. Most of us have done a better job of hiding the thing that we need to recover. Our assertiveness is a very common one. Our ability to be still is also surprisingly a very common one. But any quality can be hidden. Any quality can be denied. Any quality can be thought of as dangerous, as embarrassing, as possibly going to cause unpleasant consequences. Any quality can be thought of as one that will make other people not like or love or value or cherish us. And any quality that is seen in that way is a quality which we will do our best to hide. The unfortunate part of that is that later in life, this may very well be a quality we badly need. The person who has hidden his or her ability to stand up for themselves, because when they did as a child, they were embarrassed or punished or abused or neglected or ignored, will have a very hard time standing up for themselves with their boss if they deserve a raise, with their spouse if that person is running roughshod over them, with their children. I don't know how many clients I have treated who behave as though their children are the parents and they're the children. So you can see that just in this one example of having hidden, denied the ability to stand up for oneself, that that becomes very important to recapture, to recover. So the Lynn Show is all about making this point, that there may very well be something that you had to hide or deny or pretend was not there. And it is not too late. I don't care how old you are. It is not too late to recover it. Although recovering it quite often is a scary experience, as you can hear in Jay's experience of overcoming his obstacle to becoming who he really is. It's possible. It's not simple or easy, but it is possible. You can get more information about that in other shows that I've done, and of course on my website from the book, or by calling me. Or there's an option to email me, obviously, on the website. Now, listen to Jay. This is a wonderful story, not only because he overcame his obstacle, but because it's a fascinating, interesting, and sometimes terribly funny story. So here now, Jay Patterson. So I'm here with Jay Patterson in a conference room at the Oslo, and Jay is here as part of the ensemble cast of Glengarry Glen Ross, which is currently in production here at the Oslo. And you are playing?
Moss.
Moss. The villain of the piece in many ways.
Yeah, one of the villains.
It's hard to tell which is the villain, but Moss is the guy who causes a lot of other people trouble.
Yeah, he's the inciting cause of what ends up happening.
Yes, yes.
In the show.
Yes, and really everyone suffers.
Including Moss.
Including, right, exactly. I want to tell you that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art.
Okay.
Can that be said of you?
Yeah.
And the question I ask is, how did it get started? Not was when did you get your first job, but when, even at the beginning of your life, did you know that, I'm assuming acting is the art to which we are, which you have given large chunks of your life. So
I've been doing this for more than 40 years.
More than 40 years. So, you know, did they applaud for you when you were a child? Did you see a play and say, oh my God, I want to do that? Or do you remember what the very beginning was?
I used to do all the commercials. My dad would take me into the barber shop. I can actually remember doing this, and I would stand up on a chair and do all of the commercials that were on TV.
How old were you?
Oh God, like 5, 4 even.
Wow.
And back then everybody had a burr haircut. That was what all kids got.
Oh, right.
I guess everybody wanted their kid to look like Eisenhower. And they used to refer to me as Mr. Clean because of my big bald buzz cut. So my dad would bring me into the barber shop to get my buzz. The barber would go, oh, here comes Mr. Clean. So I can never remember wanting to do anything other than be an actor.
So so that early experience, it says a lot of things. It says,
well, that isn't really what did it. What did it was my mom and dad took me to see Mr. Roberts.
Oh.
Play about the Navy in World War II.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure where it was done. This was Cincinnati. It may have been the Thompson Shelter House Theater, which was the original Cincinnati Playhouse, which incidentally is where I ended up getting my equity card years and years later. But they did this production of Mr. Roberts, and I can remember sitting there just enthralled. And what really got me was, and I will never forget this, there was a steel hoop, a gray steel hoop, that was suspended by wire and anchored to the floor by another wire coming out of the bottom of it. And that was a porthole. And I could see the wires, and I could see that it wasn't a real window, but all these grown men are collectively
behaving as though it is.
As though it's a porthole. And I thought, well, if they believe it, I believe it.
Holy cow. How old were you then?
Oh, like 8, maybe 8 or 9. And I thought, wow, people. And on the way home from the play in the car, I asked my parents, Do people actually make a living doing that?
You're kidding.
And they said, well, not always a great living unless you're famous. But yeah, you know, people do that for a job. I said, really? These grown men make money doing that. Well, if they can, I mean, I want to do that.
Do you,
I want to do that.
It, do you,
This is interesting. I don't think I've ever heard anybody say anything quite like this. It's the creation of something that's not there.
These grown men gathering together voluntarily,
right,
to enter into a conspiracy with one another to tell a story.
And
that act,
right,
is what enthralled me. I thought, wow, these are distinguished-looking, grown-up,
right,
men, like my dad.
Right.
And they're all doing this.
Yeah.
And they're all committed to it, and they're all doing it together.
Yes.
And they all have a job to do, and they mean it.
Yeah.
So if they mean it, then it's worthy of my attention.
Wow.
That's what I think I want to do that. That's neat. You know?
Yeah, yeah, I got it. Okay, so did you act on that in any way?
Well, here's where I hit my first roadblock. When I was a kid, I had a horrible, horrible stutter.
Really?
I stuttered like a jackhammer.
Wow.
I had a terrible stutter. And speech therapy, such as it was back then, was medieval.
Yeah.
I found it humiliating and counterproductive.
Right.
And sadly, speech therapy isn't much better today. I don't think they know what to do about it. It's not a mechanical problem. There's nothing wrong with my palate or tongue or uvula. It's a psychological thing.
Yeah.
And it has to do with confidence. It has to do with understanding what you're saying. It has to do with feeling a need to make an impression and not knowing if you will be able to or not.
Yeah.
Oddly enough, it's an excellent barometer for whether or not I've done my work. If you go into rehearsal and you've been screwing around and you haven't done your work, you'll get nervous and scared, and rightly so. And you'll stutter. I was very lucky. My high school, I went to Princeton High School in Cincinnati. And we had a very gifted, energetic head of the theater program there.
So this is high school, and there was a theater program.
Oh, my goodness, yes.
Yes, this isn't true everywhere, you know.
Well, this is what I came to understand. They had the main auditorium that would hold about maybe 700 or 800 people. And stage right, there was this huge steel accordion door in the loading dock area that was unused.
Okay.
So this teacher convinced the powers that be at the school to allow him and a group of students to turn that into a small black box studio theater. They built like terraced risers and a little control booth in the back with its own power source. And they made like a 60-seat studio theater out of it. So my high school had two theaters in it.
That's amazing.
Which for the 70s in Cincinnati,
oh, amazing,
of all places.
Right.
So he taught a course called Oral Interpretation of Literature. And I took the course and did very well in it. And he said, you know, I think you're incredible. You should consider auditioning for the plays next year. I said, well, I stutter. He says, I know you stutter.
This is in your junior year, so you hadn't done before.
No. I was scared. I was scared to death to even attempt it.
Okay, so that's the obstacle you're talking about.
Yeah.
Is that you wanted it but didn't want to risk it.
I didn't think I would be able to do it.
Yeah.
And kids can be unbelievably cruel.
No kidding.
Mean, I got teased about it a lot, and I would get into fights over it because somebody would tease me, and I'd pop them. He said, I know you stutter, but you don't stutter when you do this.
Right.
And then he named the names of a couple of pretty famous actors. He said, those guys stutter. He said, you know, you have this incredible talent that you're letting lie dormant.
What a good guy.
For no legitimate reason. Try it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that summer, my mom died very suddenly. And
oh, my.
I kind of realized that...
life is short.
Yeah, I'm not going to be here forever.
Right.
And I thought, you know, you kind of owe it to yourself to at least try this. And she would want you to at least try it.
Right.
And if you try it and you don't like it, fine. But, and I wound up doing 5 plays my senior year in high school. And then I went to Ohio U at Athens, Ohio, majored in theater.
Mm-hmm.
And I haven't looked back. I mean, that's it.
So, so yet again, a teacher.
Yeah.
Who comes to the rescue. I hear this a lot, you know.
Yeah, he was very gifted, very energetic, smart. I owe him a lot.
Yes. And probably you're not the only one. So, okay, so you go to college and you major in drama.
Mm-hmm.
And then what?
I went to St. Paul, Minnesota, And I became a founding member of the Penumbra Theater Company. They're a mixed-race theater company. The first year, they hired a company of 16 actors. They hired two white men and two white women, and the rest of the company was African-American. Mm-hmm. And we did a season of six plays, one of which toured, and we taught classes, you know, to the kids in the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. This was funded by CETA. The program was discontinued. They cut the funding in the middle of a pay period and didn't tell us. So we were told that these next paychecks are going to be our last paychecks because the company was going to have to fold for a while, they said. And we get our last paychecks, and they're for less than half of what they normally were. We weren't making a tremendous amount of money, but in St. Paul, Minnesota in 1977-78, there was enough money to live on
right back
then. And you know, so I had to scuffle. I hung sheetrock. I did interior demolition work. I worked as a security guard in a bank on weekends. Mm-hmm. You know, I paid my bills.
Right. You were a grown-up.
Yeah. It's a pretty funny experience. This was when I first became aware of Sam Shepard. Mm. And he wrote this incredible play called Curse of the Starving Class. And I decided to work up one of the monologues into an audition piece. In this security company, my normal shifts were Saturday and Sundays from 7 a.m. to 3 p.m. And banks are deserted then. They had to have a warm body in the building for insurance purposes. So I was usually the only person in this bank. And,
a great place to work on material.
Absolutely.
Right.
So... they had a huge data processing center in the basement of this bank. And this was like the late 70s when banks were really starting to consolidate. So after working alone in this bank for months, all of a sudden there's all these executives that are having to come and be let into the bank so that they can get down into the data processing area to, you know, work with their tech people. And I was working on this monologue from Curse of the Starving Class, which involves a man talking to a sheep on stage. And he's describing to the sheep the process of castrating young male sheep.
Oy.
And throwing their testicles up on the roof of a building, of a shed, and then having an eagle come and, you know, take them.
Yeah, right.
I mean, there's a lot of symbolism in the monologue, but it's a weird, strangely humorous monologue. Mm-hmm. It's like a three-page monologue. So I'm working on this, and I didn't realize it, but there were a group of businessmen who had come up from the data processing area, mm-hmm. and they were standing there waiting to be let out because I had the only key.
Mm-hmm.
I would have to open the door and let them out.
Right.
And they were afraid to interrupt me because they thought I was insane.
Yes, of course.
You know.
Oh, yes.
I mean, like I'm sitting there with handcuffs and a nightstick on my belt.
Right.
And I'm, you know, doing this impassioned monologue about cutting the testicles off of young sheep.
Yes, right.
And they're like standing around holding their briefcases like, my God.
Right.
This guy's nuts.
Right.
And then I saw them and I went, oh, and then thank God I had the script with me, so I showed them the script, and they could see that I wasn't making that up.
Right.
And then I just explained the situation to them. I said, I'm going to work this up as an audition piece.
Right.
And they said, what's an audition?
So, really? That's hilarious.
So,
I'm not just a security guard.
So, yeah, that was that. That was like a funny thing that
it
happened.
It certainly was. Okay, so you're in Minneapolis?
St. Paul.
St. Paul, right?
Mm-hmm.
And how did you get out? Because you're clearly not there now.
I went home to visit my dad.
Mm-hmm.
Because I hadn't seen him in a while. And, I mean, this is in Cincinnati.
Right.
And just on a whim, I called up the Cincinnati Playhouse and asked them if I could come in and do a general audition. And they said, sure. So I go in there. They couldn't use the rehearsal room because they were rehearsing their first play of the season that year. So we go out on the stage, and all the carpenters are out there building the set.
Mm-hmm.
So I did a couple of Shakespeare soliloquies. And the guy said, wow, you're good. Why don't we go somewhere where I can hear you? I said, okay. So we go down into the dressing room. So I did a few more pieces for him, and he, you know, and they ended up offering me a small part in Twelfth Night, and that's how I got my equity card.
Wow.
So I had to move, I had to leave St. Paul and move back to Cincinnati. Mm-hmm. And I did a play there. And then...
I imagine your dad was glad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then we argued over who would get to use the car a lot. But then one of my professors from school directed a play in Chicago that summer at the St. Nicholas Theater, which doesn't exist anymore. But I went to Chicago and did a play there. And then the Playhouse called me back. The Cincinnati Playhouse called me back and asked me to come and do two other plays. And then right as the second one was about to end, they offered me a third play. Mm-hmm. And at that point, I felt I had enough experience under my belt for equity shows. And I had put away enough money that I thought, okay, now I can... I can go to New York now. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to go to New York right after college because I had seen several people that I knew try that, and they weren't ready emotionally and psychologically.
Not to mention financially.
Well, they went to New York and got slapped around pretty badly.
Yeah.
And they ended up giving it up.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, I don't want that to happen to me. You know. So I thought, I'm gonna grow up a little bit, get toughened up, you know.
Yeah, it's very wise, I think.
And
so what happened?
A complete fluke happened. This business is about relationships. Mm-hmm. You know, meeting people. I went to New York, and after a couple of weeks, I ran out of clean clothes, so I had to do laundry. So I go to a laundromat, and it's full, and I walk down 2nd Avenue a couple blocks and go into a different laundromat. And there's a guy that I had gone to college with that I hadn't seen in years. Years. You know, he said, how long have you been here? I said, oh, like a couple weeks now. And I said, I'm thinking about trying to find a place to study, because it may be a while before I do any real acting again, and I'd like to keep my skills up. Can you recommend a place to study? He said, yeah, Terry Schreiber Studio. And I said, okay, what do you like about Terry Schreiber? Why do you recommend him? He said, well, he's a director, and he works in the industry, in addition to running his own studio. Mm. He does a lot of work in regional theater and off-Broadway. He's even directed a couple of Broadway plays. And he has a reputation for occasionally using students that he thinks are particularly good.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And I thought, well, that's the kind of person that I want to work with.
Right.
I don't want to work with somebody who has given up on the idea of being a professional in our industry. I'd like to be taught by somebody who has an ongoing career. Mm-hmm. So I met him, and you know, it took a while. You know, I had to find a bread and butter job just to eat.
Right.
And then when I could afford it, I started taking class. And this play came along called K2, which he directed at a theater in Syracuse, in the Syracuse stage. Mm-hmm. It's a two-character play. It's about two men who are trapped on the side of a mountain. K2 Mountain, that's the second highest mountain on Earth after Everest. Mm-hmm. K2 are topographical map coordinates. More people have been killed climbing K2 than any other mountain.
Wow.
Just because of how it's shaped. You know, it's very treacherous. There's a lot of avalanches and stuff. It's really dangerous to climb it. What the play is about are these two friends, an assistant district attorney and his buddy who is a physicist. And they climb K2, and they're on their way down, and they fall. And they land on a tiny ice ledge on a wall of ice. The play opens the morning after they have survived a night on this ledge after falling. And they're both pretty banged up. And they have hypothermia and oxygen starvation and broken bones. And they're really banged up. And it's very clear that they won't survive another night. So they have to somehow get down. My character is so badly injured that he can't move. He just has to sit there and belay the other guy while he's on the rope. Belaying is an anchor on a free climb, someone using a rope to climb with. You have to have somebody belaying you.
In the event that
you fall, you can have somebody.
You're not going to completely fall.
Right.
Right.
So, we had to learn how to rock climb, and we had to learn how to belay. So did the play in Syracuse. Two-man play. And then a group of producers wanted to option it and take it to Broadway. Well, they aren't going to use two...
Unknowns.
Right. They then spent a year trying to find names to do it on Broadway. The hope was that myself and the other guy that did it up in Syracuse would get to be the understudies.
Right.
Which I thought was a big
break. Deal, right.
Yeah. I mean, at the time I was tending bar in a hotel.
How old were you, Bob?
28. I was 27 when I did it in Syracuse. Mm-hmm. Well, they got their names. They got Jeffrey DeMunn and Peter Boyle. They went through a whole roster of other names. I mean, John Voight and Roy Scheider were going to do it. And they were also trying to get Al Pacino. And Pacino couldn't make up his mind which of the two roles he wanted to do. That's what I was told. Mm-hmm. I wasn't in the room when any of these conversations happened. Anyway, we finally get to do it, and then we had to audition for the producers to see if we could be the understudies. We went into a Broadway theater on a Monday when it's dark, and there was a single ghost light on the stage. A ghost light is like a pipe with a big light bulb on the end of it. Mm-hmm. And that was the only light in the whole theater. And we're up on stage. We auditioned at the Court Theater, and they were doing Twice Around the Park with Eli Wallach and Ann Jackson. And the set was this upper middle class Central Park West apartment. So we're supposed to go up on this set and act like we're freezing to death on a mountain in Nepal.
Right.
I guess what the producers wanted to hear was whether or not our voices could fill a Broadway house. And I guess they needed to hear that for themselves.
Right.
So there's these very wealthy, very elderly people sitting in like a cluster about halfway up the orchestra section, wrapped in mink, you know, watching us do this.
Right.
And I was unfamiliar with the union rules. There was a coffee table right in front of us because we had to lean up against a couch, you know, sitting on the floor. And I moved the coffee table.
Oh, no, union, you're not allowed to move. Oh, my God.
And one of these producers, he was like 82 at the time, jumped up out of his chair. Joe, put the goddamn table back. You're going to have to pay the whole crew. Put it back, for Christ's sake. Put the goddamn thing back. We're going to have to pay the whole crew. So.
Oh, God.
So I thought, well, I just blew it.
Right.
You know. Right. So we got the job. They hired us. They used Peter Boyle and Jeffrey DeMunn to do the two roles. Mm-hmm. And it didn't work out with Peter Boyle. They had to cut the floor out of the Brooks Atkinson Theater and then remove the false proscenium to even build the set.
Oh, my God.
Then after they built the set, they discovered that they had misfigured the center line by almost a foot. So they had to move it. And that took 36 straight hours.
And a lot of money.
Oh, my God. So they were like over $250,000 in the hole.
Right.
They hadn't even had an audience yet.
Oh, yeah. Right.
So they told me and the other guy that was understudying not to come to rehearsal for 3 weeks because they didn't want to pay us.
Oh, my goodness.
So we show up tech week.
Right.
When they're in 10 out of 12s. And I can see that there's a lot of problems, you know.
Yeah.
And the director came to me and he said, "Are you watching this?" I said, "Yeah." He said, get ready.
Oh, my God.
And I said, "Terry, they're not going to let me step in and do this." He said, "Jay, get ready." I said, "I'm a welder's kid from Cincinnati. I'm 28. I have never done anything in New York yet.
Right.
I haven't even done a showcase because I couldn't afford to take time off from my bartending job. I'm a complete unknown. They aren't going to let a complete unknown step into a two-man play on Broadway. They won't do it." He said, "Jay, I'm telling you, get ready.
Oh, my God.
We have no time and no money to bump it another month and get another star. There's no time.
My God.
Get ready." And I went, "Okay." So 2 days later, they need to see you in the stage manager's office. I go down there, and they told me I was doing it.
Unbelievable.
So I went from tending bar in a hotel. I didn't even have an agent.
Oh, my God.
And then in one conversation, I step into a two-character play on Broadway.
Unbelievable. I don't think Fluke actually covers this. I think it's something else.
No, it fell in my lap.
Yeah, right. It's
And it, you know, the show did well, you know, considering the fact that it was a drama.
Yes, and not a pleasant drama.
No.
No,
and
right.
Out of the two characters, one is a complete unknown.
Right.
You know, it ran for 3 months.
Wow. That's not bad.
It's not bad.
It is not bad.
Under the circumstances.
Right.
It got...
They didn't make their money back, though.
No. It was nominated for 3 Tony Awards. Mm-hmm. I got an Outer Critics Circle nomination.
Wow.
I didn't win.
Right.
But the set won for Best Set.
Amazing.
Yeah. And it changed my life. I haven't had to work a non-industry job since.
Wow.
Almost 30 years ago.
Oh, my God.
So, I did my first film later that same year.
Mm-hmm.
A film called...
Well, you got an agent then, I assume.
Yeah. I had been kind of courting an agent.
Mm-hmm.
And he kept telling me, you know, I've heard good things about you from people that I know in regional theater, but I haven't seen you do anything.
And so you said, well, come to Broadway.
Well...
right. Come to opening night.
What happened was Terry, the mm-hmm. director, knew this agent. And when they offered me the understudy job, he said, look, why don't you offer it to him and ask him to handle it for you?
Mm-hmm. Right. Very smart.
So I just kind of threw that in his lap.
Him. Right.
And he said, sure, I'd be happy to handle it.
I'm sure he was. What did he have to lose?
Well, he ended up getting me a lot more money than I would have ever had
the
courage to ask for.
Right.
I knew... nothing about the business at all.
Right. He was moving tables on the stage.
Yeah, and he told me what I would be getting, and I'm like, wow, that's above minimum. He went, of course. I said, well, I would have never asked for that. He said, yeah, that's why you need an agent.
Yeah, right.
So
that's what they're for.
Yeah. So then when I took over the role, I called him.
Right.
And told him what happened, and he says, whoa, we need to renegotiate. I said, yeah, we do. So they brought some people from the agency to see a run-through.
Mm-hmm.
And then they came back to my dressing room with some papers, and from then on I had an agent.
Wow.
But I did a film later that same year called Places in the Heart.
Oh, wow.
And then my father died about 6 weeks after I finished filming. So he never got to see it.
But he didn't get to see you on Broadway?
Oh, he sure did.
I'll bet he did.
He saw the Syracuse production, and then a year later he saw the Broadway production.
God, he must have been beside himself.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
He was always, I mean, my dad was an ironworker foreman, mm-hmm. you know, foreman of welders. So he always had steady work, and he always earned a really good salary, right. You know. And I think he was concerned that I would starve.
Of course.
And he's like, You need to learn how to do something that people won't.
I love that. Oh, you're right.
You ain't going to make a living in that business.
Oh, my.
Well, my father was older.
Mm-hmm.
He was actually old enough to have been my grandfather.
Wow.
My dad was in his 50s when I was born.
Wow, so that's wonderful that he lived long enough to see you on stage.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Both of my dad's grandfathers fought in the Civil War.
Oh, my goodness.
So that's,
oh, my goodness.
There's a
really?
Generational shift there.
Yeah, wow.
My dad was 18 years older than my mom.
Wow, and she predeceased him by so much.
Yeah.
That's, what a shame. It's like this work was just waiting for you, and you arrived in New York apparently ready to take it, and took you.
It was very serendipitous.
Yes.
Well,
it was serendipitous in one way, but you were ready for it. You could do it.
Yeah.
And that's why. It couldn't have happened to someone who wasn't ready. Do you know what I mean?
Well, that's the there's some saying about this, some wise old saying about this. Luck is opportunity colliding with preparation or something like that. I've been very lucky in that I've understood what to do with things that fall in my lap.
Right.
I've had bad things happen, too.
I'm sure.
But
starting...
But even the bad things led to something else.
Well, I'm thinking that even way back in high school, you went for it. You didn't say, no, I can't do it.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, so that's clearly... a part of who you are. That when the thing shows itself, you take the risk.
I have never thought of it that way. But I guess I have, yeah.
I think you have. And that's a personality trait. That's a character trait. Not everybody has that.
Wow, okay. I've never thought of it like that. Because there were certain things that I could have done and didn't do.
Mm-hmm.
For a while, the agency that I was with was practically begging me to go to Los Angeles. And I didn't want to go to Los Angeles because I was convinced that everything was going to happen for me staying in New York. And for a long time, but it looked like it was going to. I never wanted to, and I never have, left the theater. Mm-hmm. I don't want to leave the theater completely. What they were trying to tell me was, if you go out to L.A., and do more film and television, you'll have an easier time landing work in the theater. And my argument was, you know, kind of like the Robert Frost thing, you know, knowing how way leads on to way, I doubted that I should ever come back. I thought, I don't want to go out there and get seduced.
How interesting.
And that's very presumptuous of me to even think that I would be in a position to be seduced by the money of L.A., because that ended up not happening when I went out there later. I mean, I earned a living out there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I always earned a living. I'm interested by what you saying, jumping on things when they, you know, appear. I haven't always done that.
Maybe I got it wrong, but it sounded like you didn't run off to L.A. because you didn't think that was your path, not because you were afraid of it.
No.
Right. That's so. I mean, so far you haven't given me an example of something that came to you and you didn't do it because you were afraid. I mean, you don't need to tell me any of that if you don't want to, but I haven't heard it.
No.
No, everything I've heard is that when it presented, if you believed it was something that you might do, could do, should do, even if it was scary, you did it.
Yeah.
Right. That's what it looks like.
Yeah. I've tried to.
Yeah. I think you have done.
I mean, maybe I backed down from something and I was so good at rationalizing it that
but
I don't
you didn't
remember
know.
It that way. That could be.
That could be. But
memory
even,
will play tricks on you.
Well, yeah. And it's selective, our memory.
Oh, boy.
God, yes. But, okay, so you hang out in New York and then eventually they convince you to take the leap to go.
Well, what happened in New York in the early 90s was there was a series of strikes.
Mm.
First, the writers went out. The film and television writers went out. And then the directors went out.
Oh, God, yes.
And then IATSE went out. The film and TV IATSE guys, the tech guys.
Yeah.
And the studios and the networks responded by basically shutting down production in New York. There used to be two different sets of work rules. New York had its own unique set of work rules that only applied to New York. And that was what the tech guys were unwilling to give up on. So they stopped making films in New York. Between 83 and 91, I did 11 films in 9 years. Out of New York.
Out of New York.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
And then it all stopped. And the only thing that was going was Law and Order.
Right.
And I had already done Law and Order twice. And it's like, how many, you know, I'm not a regular on Law & Order.
Right.
How many times have...
Will they use you?
Yeah.
Right.
So I thought, well, I guess it's time to go to L.A. It was like everybody over 30 went out to L.A. And on the one hand, it was good because I had this wealth of friends that I had known all those years in New York.
Right. You went out in a group.
In fact, we even started an L.A. branch of our developmental theater company, the Ensemble Studio Theater, which mm-hmm. has been going since 1968.
Wow.
And now there's a thriving L.A. branch.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the result of this Grapes of Wrath-style exodus out to California
right.
in the early 90s.
Right.
So there was a community out there.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, I did episodic television, I did MOWs, I did movies.
What's an MOW?
Movie of the Week.
Ah, thank you.
You know, like a made-for-TV movie.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And enough people remembered me from the theater that I would get calls to come back east and do plays.
Mm-hmm.
I did, like, at least one play a year back here the whole time I was out there.
Wow.
I was out there 7 years. And then I did a play in Seattle that got optioned for Broadway with Julie Harris.
Oh, my.
I got to play her son.
Oh, my.
What a joy.
Oh, my. What play was it?
It was a play called Scent of the Roses, and it was about South Africa.
Ah.
So you had to do that Afrikaans Boers dialect.
Aye, aye.
60 days in the rand for one painting, ma. One painting. 60 days in the rand. It changes everything, ma.
Oi.
Very hard dialect.
Oh, my God.
It's like Australian with Dutch endings to words.
God.
Very hard to learn.
But you did.
Somebody from South Africa would...
Might not say
would
so,
sit
right.
here and listen to me do that and go, get out of here.
Yeah, right, right.
Get out of here.
Yeah. But the New York audience or the Seattle audience yeah. wasn't going to do that, right, right.
So, as it turned out, they were pulling our leg about the money.
Oh.
They strung us all along for a year, and they didn't have the money. We ended up doing a tune-up run at a theater in Nyack, which is right outside of the city.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were told that that would be it.
My God.
So I had my apartment in L.A. sublet to somebody.
Oh, so you had no place to go.
And I was living in a sublet in Manhattan.
Right.
And I had all this time because right. I didn't want to just kick the person out of my apartment.
Right.
And I thought, well, maybe this is happening for a reason.
Mm-hmm. Here I am back in New York.
Yeah. So I bumped into a buddy of mine.
Yet again.
And he told me about a co-op building up in the Inwood section of Manhattan, which is the very northern tip of Manhattan. And he said they're selling the apartments very cheap because they're below the owner-occupant threshold that lending institutions prefer. So lending institutions are kind of nervous about lending somebody money to buy an apartment in a co-op because they are collectively owned. And they would prefer that the co-op own a controlling interest in the building.
Mm-hmm. And in this one didn't.
And it didn't. So they were keeping the prices low to encourage people to buy in as owners.
Right.
And I just happened to bump into this guy who knew about the building on that day,
mm-hmm.
on a given day. And
yet again.
It's the same game, right?
Of course, right.
Bounced on it.
Right.
And went back to L.A., packed everything up in a U-Haul, and drove back across the country.
And so that's your home now? Is
and
that
now
apartment?
I'm back
that,
in
that,
New
that
York,
condo
where I belong.
Right. And when was that?
2000.
Oh, gosh, wow.
So I've been back in New York now almost 13 years.
Yeah, right.
And I just... The theater matters in New York.
Yes, I know.
And it does lead to other work.
And anyway, you seem to be doing fine.
I'm earning a living.
Yeah. It's which, as we know, what do they say? 1% of the actors in the union are actually making a living, or something like that.
Yeah.
You want to talk a little bit about Glengarry?
Mm-hmm.
Have you done it before? Did you?
I understudied three roles in the 2005 revival that was done on Broadway with Alan Alda.
Uh-huh.
And Liev Schreiber and Jeffrey Tambor.
Wow.
And Frederick Weller, Gordon Clapp, and Jordan Lage, and Tom Wopat. That was one of the most extraordinary pieces of theater I've ever seen. I got to watch that every night for months. I ended up going on a lot.
Mm-hmm. Was Moss one of them?
Moss was one of the roles that I covered. Moss was played by Gordon Clapp in that production.
Mm-hmm.
Gordon was in NYPD Blue for 11 years.
Mm.
And he was in all of John Sayles' early films. And he played a Marine general in Flags of Our Fathers. You know, the Iwo Jima thing. If you saw a picture of me, you go, oh, yeah.
Right. So
Gordon never missed a show, so I never got to go on for Moss.
Oh, how funny.
But the other two roles that I covered were the Patsy, Link, and the detective, Balin. And I ended up going on like a total of 9 times.
Wow.
For, you know, between those two parts. I always wanted to go on for Moss, and I never got to.
Oh, well, see that?
But I had to learn the role.
Yeah, right.
So when this came along, I thought, oh, my God, I have the opportunity to...
To actually do it.
I pounced on it.
Yet again.
I've always wanted to play Moss.
Mm-hmm.
Always.
So did they audition you in New York?
Yes.
Yeah. It's amazing and wonderful. So do you want to say anything about this production?
terrific group of people.
God, yes.
This is a first-class theater, mm-hmm. and I am so delighted to have the chance to do this role mm-hmm. at a really top-shelf theater. Mm-hmm. It's a dream. It's an absolute dream come true.
Who directed this?
Carl Forsman.
Oh, yeah, I don't know him.
Carl had his own company in New York called the Keene Company, mm-hmm. and now he's the chairman of the theater program at the North Carolina School of the Arts.
Mm-hmm. So. It's great. It's very well directed. But oh, you guys are all amazing, so I'm not sure how much you needed.
You always need a director.
Yeah.
You always do. Mm-hmm. Carl was great.
Good.
It was just great.
Okay, so the only other question I ask is that having given a life to this work, which you really have, is there anything that you would say about what that's like?
It's hard on relationships. Mm. If you're working, you're gone, often great distance away. And it's like you leave a void in another person's life.
Yes.
And your absence creates a void in your own life by the absence of that relationship. And, you know, whether you know it or not, whether you like it or not, that void kind of closes up a little bit during the absence. And then when the two of you come back together, you have to kind of renegotiate things.
Yes.
That can be hard. And when you're not working, you're insane.
Yes, right.
You know, you're worried about money. You're,
yes.
You know, what's going to happen down the road? You know, what if what I've done so far is as good as it gets? I mean, what if? I mean, you can drive yourself nuts with the what ifs.
Right.
And the yeah buts.
Right. Even when you have reason to believe that the future will reflect the past and you will continue to do what you've always done.
Well, that's kind of up to me, isn't it? You have to show up and do your best. Mm-hmm. You know, if you take the work seriously, if you respect your colleagues, show up with an attitude of service.
Yes.
What do you need? What do you need? Show up and ask people what they need. Mm-hmm. And, you know, approach a job with the goal of doing your best. Then your love of it will be reflected in what you do.
And people will see that.
Yeah, and people will see that, hopefully.
And I could be
and
wrong.
And I haven't been completely perfect on that. I'm immature in some ways. When I was younger, I thought that things ought to be happening more on a, you know, fame and fortune level. And, you know, I've already accumulated enough that I shouldn't have to put up with this and this anymore and blah, blah, blah. My friend called that a bad case of don't they know who I think I should be by now-itis. Which can be a very serious ailment for an actor to develop.
Yes, it certainly can.
And
because it gets in your way.
Well, you
start behaving out of that, that's going to act.
That's where your friends come in.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, fortunately, I had a very brief bout of that. Mm-hmm. And I had a couple of friends that just said, look.
This is the reality.
Yeah.
Right.
I have to be very careful how I describe this because I don't want to name anybody's name. But I saw another actor in another city before I moved to New York. I saw this actor play Cyrano. And I sat there with my mouth hanging open. He was so brilliant. Just magnificent performance. And I came to New York, and about the second or third month that I was living in New York, I went out to dinner with some friends one night, and I saw that same guy waiting tables.
Oh, my God.
And I thought, if you're looking for predictability and fairness,
you're in the wrong business.
Whatever that is.
Right.
You're living on the wrong planet, let alone being in the wrong business.
Right. That's right.
It was incredibly sobering mm-hmm. and frightening and humbling. And I thought, all right, do your best.
Right. It's all you can do. It's exactly what you said in high school. I'll do this and I'll do my best.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I'm quite sure that pays off. And it doesn't hurt that you have an extraordinary talent, which people clearly see.
Well, I hope so. If you don't love it, if you don't truly love the work, I think you're wasting your time.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you look at all the ups and downs that you have to put up with, if you don't love it, you're you're kind of screwed. Mm-hmm. And I'm very lucky in that I still love it.
Mm-hmm. You love the work itself.
Yeah. I still wouldn't do anything else, and I think that's what I'm the most grateful for.
This is a good place to stop. Thank you very much, Jay.
Thank you.
I still wouldn't do anything else, and that is what I am the most grateful for. And that line captures what it is I am talking about. I am grateful to be who I am, to be doing, in this case, what I love. But that is simply an extension of that of the idea that this is who I am and I am being it. And not because it's easy. That, of course, Jay makes that point very well, that it's not about doing it because it's easy. It's about doing it because it is who I am. So, in this way, as I said, Jay makes the point for me that it is possible to be who you are, that it isn't always easy, but that the rewards are worth it. I don't know how else to say it. That when you are who you are, there is a sense of correctness, a sense of honoring yourself. There may be difficulty, but there isn't regret. Regret is poisonous. So, have you thought of something that you always wanted to do or be? Are you thinking about yourself and what you may have denied, hidden from, avoided? Do you want to take a shot? I hope so. Now, as always, I need to thank the remarkable, incredible, I could not do without, Josh Hackney, who is my IT guru and so much more. There's virtually nothing I need to do with any kind of technology that Josh doesn't know how to do, doesn't know how to find, and isn't generously able to do. So if you need help with anything, computer, electronics, recording, design, pretty much anything that requires any kind of technology, you want Josh. And you can get him like you can get me at the website thelinshow.com. Remember not to leave the E out of Lynn. As always, I hope that you got something that you can use from this show. Something that inspired you, something that made you laugh, something that you didn't know that you now know, something you knew that you forgot, something that will bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station. And I certainly hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Always in my face and figure. I've both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing. Not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night.